This is the beginning of class 2.
Sanshi Bhagi Jashimeta Sham Rira Vinshi Nyende Kempati Sange Shindu Mite Kuwagi Jogu Nanda Shimba Jubashu Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kyasu Chi Dagi Chunyen Dibbe Sunam Ki Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma
believe in these things, and I used to just sit down and try to meditate, and they really do work. They really do work to prepare your mind. I don't know quite why they work, and I don't know how it is, but they really do work. If you try, if you compare Coke and Pepsi, you know, if you try to do a meditation without them and then try to do one with them, they really make a big difference. They really do facilitate your meditation. And I'm not, I had all these theories why, but I'm not quite sure, but it really does work. So we'll go through those six and through those seven. And we have to go fairly briefly because of all we have to finish in 6 weeks. But there is a book which is Liberation in Our Hands, or Liberation in the Palm of Your Hands. And we happen to have it here also downstairs. If you need one, let me know. And it's very long. It contains a very long description of each of these. And you could have one of those. Or you could get it at the bookstore, Patala, right?
Who wrote that?
It was written by Prabhakar Rinpoche, who is our root teacher's teacher. And he's also the teacher of the Dalai Lama's teacher. And it's basically the Lama Rinpoche. Lama Rinpoche doesn't have a lot on the six preliminaries. In fact, what it has is in your notebook. You know, that great text of Tsongkhapa doesn't have a lot. So when Pabanko Rinpoche wrote his Lamrim, the first third basically is, you know, a couple hundred pages on it. And then Tsongkhapa spent a lot of his book on concentration, meditation, and emptiness, wisdom. And so Pabanko didn't write that much about it because Tsongkhapa had pretty much covered it. So we're going to study meditation from the person who wrote the smaller presentation, and we're going to study the six preliminaries from the person who wrote the smaller presentation. Otherwise, it would take about a year. So we'll start with the six preliminaries. First one is what?
Cleaning up your room.
Yeah, cleaning up your room, which is Nekan Chido, actually. And it means this. My theory, it's not in the books that I've read, but my theory is that it gets you out of bed and moving physically. In the monastery, they're sweeping the floor with this broom. And it doesn't matter if the place is not dirty. You still get up and do something. You know, vacuum or... I have a theory that it's to get you awake and out of sleep or disengaged from your office if you're doing it in the evening. I think morning is better if you can. But it gets you up and it gets you moving around the house. So and also they say that the act of cleaning that place is a cause for your paradise later. Cleaning up the place acts to help you create your paradise later. You would understand that better if you studied emptiness. And also the Abhidharma Kosha includes a very specific list of virtues connected to working physically around a holy place, around a stupa or a temple or your altar. It's called Zele Chungwe Gyewa. So that really has some important meaning. And also, as you get to meditating every day for a long time, say 6 months, your mind starts to get more orderly in a way. And you actually feel more comfortable meditating in a room, which is sort of neat. I guess I'm not one to talk, but anyway, it helps. It does help. So that's the first preliminary. It's very important. Second one is what?
Offering,
okay. There are... The traditional offering is these seven bowls. And
seven what?
Seven water bowls up there. You see them up there? And those represent an offering to the senses, the five senses. And they also come from ancient India. And they are the traditional offerings that you would give a king or a great person. Like if the Dalai Lama were going to come to your house, it are the traditional offerings that you would give a king or a great person. Like if the Dalai Lama were going to come to your house in ancient India, there would be seven steps by which you would greet him. And that's what those seven bowls represent. So if you can get a hold of a set of those seven bowls. Somebody from the other class said that they knew where to get them. If you need them. I tried in Delhi last time I was there. And they're hard to get. But apparently people are signing in the United States, although a little bit expensive. More expensive
so
than India.
Has
yeah? I like the... there's one made out of bell metal. It's a white metal. It's not silver, but it looks like silver. And it doesn't get dirty. And those are kind of nice. These are brass or copper, and they're hard to keep clean.
You know, you can get them made out of glass, too, like at a houseware store.
Yeah.
It's real simple.
Yeah. So I think that's nice if you can. You stack them up together, and you fill up the top one with water. Clean, should be clean water. And then you pour all but a little bit into the next bowl and set the first bowl on the left side. So you've got all seven bowls in your hand. You fill up the first one with water. They're stacked. And you take up the first one and you pour most of it into the next bowl and then you set the first bowl down on the left side. And that first bowl represents water for drinking. It represents a beverage that you would give to that person who is visiting your house. In India, if you've been there, you know, if you walk into a house after being outside, very nice to get something to drink. I mean, that was probably very common, that the first thing you would do would give someone a drink of water. Then you take the second bowl up and pour most of it into the third bowl, and you put the second bowl down. And that represents padyam in Sanskrit. Padyam comes from the word pad, which came into Latin as ped, which means what? What's a pedestrian?
Foot.
Yeah, someone on foot. And it represents water for washing the feet. I think you see in the Bible people washing people's feet. And it's considered a very big offering in a hot country and in the Middle East and in Asia, people's feet. And it's considered a very big offering in a hot country and in the Middle East and in Asia, because someone else's foot, if you've been in India again, you wear sandals, and there's lots of dirty stuff on the all over on the ground, and your feet get dirty, and sometimes it's really bad stuff, you know, like cows walk around everywhere. And it doesn't matter where you walk in India, you're bound to walk into a cow pile somewhere. They're not prevented from walking all over the traffic. They walk through the city, and you're not allowed to hurt them. So it's a very much an act of humility to wash someone's feet. And I think in the Bible they do it in the same manner. So the second one is offering water to clean the person's feet. The third one is called Pushpa, which means flower. You're offering a flower. So the first offering has been an offering to the sense of taste. And the second offering has been an offering to the sense of what?
Touch.
Yeah. And now the third one is an offering to the sense of smell and sight. It's a beautiful flower. So you put, again, you've poured the contents of the third bowl mostly into the fourth bowl and then set the third bowl down. Working your way to the right, to your right. And that represents the flower. And then the next one, the fourth bowl, is dhupe, which means incense. And that's sweet to the sense of smell. So it's... okay. Next one is offering lamp. And in India, it would have been a wick put into oil, and the best kind of oil is from clarified butter, most expensive, makes the nicest light. So that's an offering of light. Next one is called Gande in Sanskrit, and it means water mixed with some holy perfumes that you are offering to the holy person's body. It's like a perfume. And that's again a sense of smell.
And then, the lamp was for the sight?
Yeah. And then the seventh one is nyudi or rase, which means food, an offering of food. And there's really an eighth one, which is music. You offer music. And sometimes another bowl is set out, and sometimes you just put your bell up on the altar. So those are the seven offerings, and then the eighth is sort of optional. The Tibetans would offer water. You can also, and in certain rituals, you fill them up with the actual object, so that the first one is actually clean water, and the second one is actually some kind of perfumed water that you would wash someone's feet with. And then the third one is actually, you actually put a flower in the bowl. So you can do it either way. But the Tibetan lamas, the tradition of Tibet was put water in the bowls. And the idea is that no sane person who is offering water will feel any hesitation about that he's spending too much. Because it's a very bad deed if you... You know, if you go out and have to buy an expensive flower, and then you have to go out and buy some cookies, they like blue cookies, they're expensive, and things like that. And they say it would be a very bad deed if you had any hesitation about making the offering. So water is considered, it's free, you know, and no one who offers water is ever going to think, oh, I overspent on this water, you know, it should be a very bad deed. The bowl should be in a straight line. I don't think these are too straight to me. And they should be not touching and not too far apart. And they say about the width of a piece of rice. And that's just, it's to represent that the lineage of the tradition should never be, be discontinued. That the teachers and students should always be close enough that the Dharma can be continued in a continuum. And it doesn't mean that if you spread them out too far, you're not going to meet a lama. It's just that it's a nice thing to think about while you're arranging your altar. It's again, it's because things are empty. The more symbolism you give it, and the more you can concentrate while you do it, if as you're setting them out, it occurs to you that it's very possible that you could live in a world where there are no teachers, where you'd never meet anyone who knew enough to help you, that you should think about that in the morning before you start. So that's a very good thing to think about while you're putting out the offerings. Then there should be on the altar somewhere a representation of the Buddha's body and a representation of his speech and a representation of his mind, which you can cover if you have an image of the Buddha, and then some scripture, if you keep some scripture on the altar. In fact, the word for altar in Tibetan is a support for the body, speech, and mind, for the holy body, speech, and mind. That's the word for altar in Tibetan. It's kusum tukten. So it's confusing.
You said water bowls for the five senses, and what are the other three things?
It doesn't relate only to five. I mean, two of them are taste. You know,
I heard it's also consciousness and.
Yeah, it could be. It's probably in the extent. Yeah. It can be that too. Normally, it's like a kusum table. So that's offering, and then try to put something fresh out every morning. Yeah, in the evening, you take it down the same way. You start from the left, you pour out the one on the left, and then you turn it over. And then you pour out the next one, and you lean it up on the first one, like that. You don't stack them on each other, you lean them up like this, so they'll be leaning up on each other. And it was a Kadampa tradition. Kadampas were the early Buddhists, they were like the early Christians, they were the early fanatic Buddhists in Tibet, and they were like the first American Buddhists, if you want. Maybe we can be like that. I think we could be like that. And they were the converts. They were the ones who had been something else and were now Buddhists. So they practiced very well. And they were famous. Because they had a lot of hardships, too. The country wasn't Buddhist at that time. And they had a lot of hard times. And they were just learning everything, and it was a very exciting time. If I once tried to draw, I got confused about who was whose teacher. So I went through the Blue Annals, which is like this big, and I tried to chart who was whose teacher, and it turned out like a tumbleweed. So it'd be like somebody would go to India and learn Abhidharma, and he'd come back, and somebody else would go and learn Madhyamika. So then the guy who learned Abhidharma would teach his friend Abhidharma, and that person would teach him Madhyamika, and people were each other's teachers. And it was really a beautiful time. And they would practice very hard, and they concentrated a lot on meditation. There's very few books left from those times, only a few. And they would say that you should turn them over at night, put out the water, and turn them over at night to represent that you're ready to die tonight. You know, now I lay you down to sleep, you know. And that's the purpose of turning them over. It means, okay, I've finished all my work. If I die an hour from now in my sleep, that's okay. Sort of to remember your impermanence. And then the water you should collect in a bowl, and they say that you should throw it in a place, it's almost like holy water now, and you shouldn't throw it in a place where people would step on it, like on a roadway, or that's going to go straight into the sewer or something like that. Try to put it on some plants, or try to throw it, if you can, the ocean or a river is a very nice place to throw it.
But if you can't, you have no plants. Plants in the
Out your window, something like that. You know what I mean? Someplace. I mean, not if you.
But the window falls on the floor on the street.
No, I mean, I used to pour it on the wall that would drip down and not reach the sidewalk or something. You know, I lived in a place where there was nowhere else. You know, so you know, improvise.
The boy,
where there's a will, there's a way.
What if you drink it?
I don't know. I think that's great. I don't remember reading that anywhere. We use it to flower our plants. I think it'd be fine to drink.
Is it inappropriate to not change the water every day?
You're supposed to change it every day.
Does it matter if you don't? I mean,
well, it's like offering the Dalai Lama, you know, a hard donut or something. Really. And I'm the worst. I mean, I don't sleep enough, and I get up. I don't want to mess around. You know, but it's not good. Your meditation won't be good. You have to take time to do these things. it's sort of like, especially like when you're in a retreat, if you do all the proper offerings for certain retreats, it takes like an hour and a half in the morning or 2 hours. And it's correct to do it. You know, it really works. I just say try it. You know, what you do is, what it means is, it's kind of like making a commitment to the meditation. It's like saying, I think this meditation is important enough that I should do it really properly. And I'm an offender, you know, I'm admitting it. But you really should, otherwise the meditation doesn't come out. And after you pour out the water, wipe them. And before you pour the water in, wipe them, make them clean. Even if they don't look dirty, it's just a ritual action that you do. I think Westerners, and I know myself too, we don't like ritual. You know, ritual is synonym for something mindless. But it's not like that. It really does work. And the meaning you give it, you know, if you do it mindlessly, I guess it is mindless. You know, if you just do it because you have to do it, A, you won't do it very long. And B, it won't help your meditation very much. You have to really imagine that you are setting these things out in front of beings who are really going to come. And if you don't think so, if you don't believe they can come, then don't bother. Why meditate? The idea is to become like a being who is Buddha, and Buddha is omniscient. If he knows you wish him to come, he's there. In fact, he can't even premeditate it. That's the nature of a Buddha. He's just there. When you're ready and you really would like him to be there, he's there. Because his nature is mental, mostly. And if you don't believe in all that, then there's not much reason to... In one way, logically, you have to not believe in it. We don't get to the proof for the existence of a Buddha until about our 15th year in the monastery. You know? You don't really know they exist, to tell you the truth. But you have to have some intention then. At this point, you have to sort of believe that that's why you're here. You know, it's to explore the possibility, A, of getting out of suffering permanently, B, of becoming a being who could help all other beings perfectly. And you can't demonstrate that those exist. But you know suffering exists. So I would say work from that. You know, work from your knowledge that you are suffering. And this claims to be a way out, and the description of suffering is so perfect that possibly these people have some antidote for it. No one else is even describing suffering. You see what I mean? So you're going to the one people in the world who are saying life is very bad and this is happening. Get out of that aging process and the process of everything that ever succeeds in your life collapsing, which it will. Your health, your looks, your strength, your mind will all deteriorate by their very nature. There's no other choice. So if someone tells you that truly, and you can corroborate it, then if they say, I also know the way to fix it, then you should at least take interest. So offer them, and really do understand that if there is such a being, he can partake of that. The Buddhas don't drink the water, and we don't believe they drink the water. They don't need water. But it's the action of wishing that they could. You try to imagine that they take from that water what they can get out of that water, which is bliss, and which is all knowledge. And they can't. When they experience the water and you experience the water, it's a different thing. So there's no thing of trying to make them feel less thirsty or something. They're not. They don't get thirsty. It's from your side. It's to help you. It's not that they need 7 little bowls of water to make it. And no Buddhist believes that. So that's offering. That's the offering. Then if you have some favorite things to offer, that's nice too. That's good too. And the music, you know, in general, music can be a big distraction to your meditation. And especially while you're meditating, you shouldn't have any music on. And in general, it can be a real distraction. But if you can mentally make it an offering and try to concentrate on that and not fool yourself that you're not just listening to your favorite song, then it's a good thing. So offer that. Okay. What's the third one?
Question.
Yeah.
You're talking about the Buddha.
Yeah.
Is the Buddha Buddha? Is it Buddha that we're offering to? Buddhas or Buddhas and deities or bodhisattvas or what?
In the text, it's all enlightened beings and all beings who are pretty far along the path. And in the when we do our monk's confession twice a month, you're supposed to imagine the offering. We do some tormas. You're supposed to imagine that every being in the world can experience this offering. So I think you could say that. You know, the text goes, Rajam Namla Puvadan, Sanjan Namla Jimbadan. So it's both. It's actually both enlightened beings. And you wish that all normal people could also experience pleasure from that offering. Each to his capacity. So that's the offering. Next one?
Okay.
Next preliminary, third.
Posture.
Yeah, get down properly on your seat. You've been meditating on this, right? And the text says, so Gaba says, he quotes some texts, if you've read the reading in the back of the book, which you should have done by next week, okay? You should have read everything in the back there.
Back of this book?
Yeah, in the back of the notebook. It describes the six preliminaries from Tsongkhapa and the seven ingredients. And he quotes some ancient texts that say, press the two together, by which he means do a full lotus. And we'll get into that later. We'll get into the posture, the correct posture later. And then Tsongkhapa and the texts say a half lotus is okay too. For those of you like me, who if I get into a full lotus, I can't get out of it. And it doesn't help me meditate much because I'm in such agony that I can't concentrate. So you should put the left foot up first. That's tradition. Put up your left foot first. If you can only do a half lotus is left foot on top of your right thigh, and then the other leg not in a full lotus, which would be up on top of your left thigh, but rather just straight, just down on the ground. And we'll get into all that. It's really important to have a totally, totally comfortable seat for you. Okay, try different seats. You know, some people like these Japanese things. I don't. I tend to fall over on those. Your butt is, the back is supposed to be higher than the front. The back of the cushion is supposed to be higher than the front. And make sure under your legs that there's some cushion. Even under your legs, you know, if you're sitting on those, put another thin, I use, this one is good, put a thin one under the front of your legs, because the circulation will be a lot better, and then you can concentrate. And we'll talk about it later. Eventually, when you get good at meditating, your feet will fall asleep, your legs will fall asleep, and just let it go. And we'll talk about it more later. But get into some good position. And we'll talk about the proper position later. Do going for refuge. Right? That was also part of the third preliminary. We'll talk about refuge. So the third preliminary had three parts to it. Get into the right posture. Go for refuge. And try to think about bodhicitta. What is refuge? Refuge means, anybody have a definition? Who should I pick on? Rajita. What's going for refuge? Remember the definition from the final?
It's two components.
What is
it? It's go looking for object to hold on. To put the whole.
Yeah. Because of what?
Because you need help.
Yeah, that's all. It's why a kid goes to mommy. It has some, what are the two causes?
comes fear.
Fear and
hope.
And belief that this thing can help. So there's actually two states of mind inside of refuge. And we studied it in great depth the last course. But the first one is just fear. If you're not afraid, you don't know what's going on. Okay? Your condition is very serious. It's hopeless. I mean, you can... We don't break down. Some people do. But I think maybe those people actually recognize what's really going on. But you have no... there's no object in your normal everyday life which can give you any help. And I told kids, I used to teach this to kids, Mongolian kids. You know, somebody steals something from you, who do you call? The police. If your house burns, you call... You take refuge in the firemen. If you get sick, you take refuge in the doctor. But I live in a temple, and we have 1,000 members or so. And everyone shows up sooner or later. And when they show up is when someone dies. You know? Or when they get very old or very sick. You know, they go to other refuges first. They go to worldly refuges. They go through the gamut of worldly refuges. They go to the police. They go to the court. They go to the doctor. Then they go to the specialist. And then they go to the most expensive place they can find. And then they come to the temple. Because it's obvious that there's nothing left. We had last night, like 11 o'clock at night, we had two Tibetans came. Their father died. Haven't seen them for years. You know, this is refuge. Refuge means what you do, where you go when you have a fear, a true fear, which is death, and what will happen after death. So Buddhist refuge is, the first part is fear. You're afraid of what's going to happen when you die. You could die anytime. And you want to find someone who can help you about it. And then the second one is to believe that this teaching can help you. And those two components are necessary to take refuge. So really the state of mind of refuge is different than all the daily activity you do, because all day long you are seeking something. The reason you move your body at any given time is to go look for something. Is to go get something you think is going to give you some kind of happiness. That's why you move at all, ever. You will get up from this class because you want to go home and have a drink and go to bed and watch some TV. And, you know, that's what you seek for happiness. So that's why you move any time during the day. That's why you move your arm or your head. You think it will make you feel good. And refuge is that. You have to... All of those actions are useless. You know, all of those worldly actions, those daily activities have no... They're not relevant to refuge. They're not refuge. When you finally do something to help you at death, then that's the first time you've ever taken refuge. And that's the first time you qualify as a Buddhist. That's a minimum requirement to be a Buddhist. Is that thought finally occurring to you that I should do something to prepare for my death? You're not a Buddhist until that happens. Technically, you're not a Buddhist.
What happens if you, let's say, you're suffering a lot and you want to get out of the suffering? Would you be still a Buddha? I mean, Buddhist?
If you have to always think. Actually, no. It's the minimum is to worry about your next life. That's the minimum. That, you know, that was in the definition of a lower scope person.
Yeah, but even if you have a fear of suffering for this life and next life, would that be?
And
next life. That's but suffering, but not. You don't think of death.
What makes it Buddhist refuge is the fear about what will happen when you die. And that's why I object to some, you know, there's Buddhist teachings which are trying to make Buddhism out to be something to make you calm in this life. It doesn't qualify as a Buddhist teaching. It'll be nice if we were calm. We will be calm when we take care of our death. We'll be calm now when we know we'll die well. But the minimum is to prepare for that time. That's Buddhist. That's the object of Buddhist practice. Minimum object. You can't do much about this life to make yourself happy. You can't feed yourself so much that you'll never have to eat again. You can't take enough vitamins that you're never going to get sick and die. It's too late. You know. Minimum is for death. And And the rest is just like sort of psychological satisfaction in this life. And I don't know if it can even happen. I guess it can if you're a very high practitioner and you do everything well. Maybe something will change. But that's a side effect. Anyway, so that's refuge. Bodhicitta is called kunmong chuba, which means to do this practice in order to help other people. To go into this meditation with the intention that it should help other people.
What was the word?
Bodhicitta means desire to reach your own paradise, so that you can finally help other people reach that. And that something about that thought, even if it's so flimsy as we have it, and you know what I mean? I don't really have any intention to go help all of these, you know. But it, just to imagine it before you meditate makes something happen. It makes the, you know, even if you just dryly think about it for 30 seconds, which is about all we do, it still makes the meditation really good. It has some tremendous power in the meditation. And if you don't have that thought, then you won't be able to achieve the final goal. And that again relates to emptiness. If you understand emptiness well, you understand that you have to get this intention, this motivation in order to achieve it. So that's the third one. What's the fourth one? Yeah. It's called merit field. What does merit field mean?
Two great images of emptiness and compassion.
Yeah, but the word merit field here, you know, you say merit field and I think of gravitational field or something. You know, I used to think, I don't know what they mean by field. Field is probably better translated as garden or something. It means that by you bring into the room a being who is so holy that anything you do towards him has incredible effects. And this is like in the Abhidharma, they explain that if you give a piece of food to a dog, you get a certain good result, a certain good karma. If you give that same piece of food to a human being who has no spiritual qualification, no spiritual goodness in him much, just a normal person, you get a higher virtue than if you gave it to the dog, because that person has the capacity to reach nirvana in this life, no matter who he is, except for certain kinds of beings. That person is a higher level of being than the dog, because the dog, no matter how much you teach him or instruct him, under normal circumstances, it's impossible for a dog to learn nirvana. So it's much holier to give it to a normal person. And then if you give it to a bodhisattva, it's much more powerful than if you gave it to the normal person. Because this being has a high likelihood of reaching nirvana or Buddhahood in this life. And then if you give it to a Buddha, then it's even greater. And if you give it to your lama, it's greater than that. And if you give it to your father and mother, it's greater. I mean, it's somewhere there between, before bodhisattvas. Very high garden, a very high field. They discuss fields as a whole small section of the Abhidharma. Your parents, because of all the energy they put into keeping you alive after you were born and taking care of you. So as a result, they're a very high field.
What happens if your parents do not take care of you? And then 20 years later they show up and I say, oh, you know,
I've had this question, you know, from many Westerners. Many Westerners say, I was mistreated by my parents. You know, are they still a virtue of the field? I don't know your circumstances or the one that you might be thinking of, but I think that most Westerners don't consider, until they've been a parent, I guess, how many hours and how much thought goes into caring for the child, even if you abuse him later, you know. I mean, the first 3-4 years, if you paid the person by the hour, you know, if you paid him for his mental agony of having to concentrate that this child shouldn't get in any kind of mortal danger any time of 24 hours of the day, if you paid him for that mental hassle, I mean, it would be a big salary, you know. I mean, it's constant attention for the first few years. And I don't care how bad they were to you later. That's the great kindness. You can't match teaching you to speak, teaching you to move, teaching you any kind of human civility is a great kindness, and they do it. And almost every parent does it. Right? I can't imagine many that don't. Yeah.
Well, as you so often point out, keeping emptiness in mind, even if your parents were absolutely vile to you, you could still replace that with the mental ideal of what parents are like and use that, couldn't you?
You could. What I'm saying is that even what you call a bad parent, if there were a scorecard, I mean, it would be
Michael,
billions
of the other day they showed on TV this parents that had like 11 kids living in filth with sickness. I mean, I wouldn't call those parents.
Well, right. Anyway, what qualifies them as the main thing that qualifies them as kind, according to the Abhidhamma, is that they give you a body and mind which are capable of reaching nirvana. So, I mean, once you're conceived or born, they've already done that. That the main kindness they give you, which is the body and mind that it enables you to reach beyond death, that's according to Abhidhamma, that's the greatest kindness already. Not just
they do it for, to give you life. They're not conscious of that. They do it for pleasure, to have sex. And
yeah,
then they do it
true.
Because they want to be taken care of when they're older. They don't want to be left alone. That's a fear.
No, it's true. It's true.
So
the motivation is
their motivation is not there.
No, if your motivation is not 100%, but you still do, if you still save a person's life, you still get much of the virtue of that deed. The motivation is only a quarter of the good deed. The motivation can be lousy, but if you happen to save a person's life with a lousy motivation, I want to become a hero, I want to get in the newspaper, you know, whatever, still, the virtue is incredible. The virtue of providing the causes for a being to be able physically and mentally to reach beyond death, beyond suffering, is limitless. So that's all.
Because obviously the Westerners are not going to be with the
reincarnation. No, they're not conceiving a child and saying, oh, he's going to reach me.
Even Tibetans, I think, don't think about
it. I must how this ties to the merit field.
I'm just explaining the idea of relative merit fields. Mm-hmm. Every being is a merit field. So you take the highest one, mm-hmm. which is a lama, mm-hmm. which is your root lama, whoever he is. Mm-hmm. And Root Lama is a very interesting thing. I mean, you will know the day when you meet your Root Lama. You will have some kind of a relation with him. And it may not be that he's the one who teaches you the most. And it may not be, you know, that he's the one you expected. It may not be any kind of monk, lama, Buddhist, anything. There will be a being in your life that you understand is your root lama, and the one who teaches you, the one who takes you to this knowledge, and you have to find this person, and when you know, you'll know, you know, and then you have to imagine if you have this root lama, you have to imagine that being there. When you invite the beings, frankly, I've studied many years. I've studied most of the great books ever taught in the monasteries. Edited them, translated them, debated them. I can't visualize all these lamas, you know. I mean, start out, the idea of meditation is to start out with a minimum. It's better to start with too little than to try to do five lamas at once and then for years you don't get anywhere. Pick the one lama that you have the best connection with, the one that comes up in your heart the easiest, and they say, make his outline first, like a silhouette, like you're in a, you know all these on the news at night, they don't want you to see the guy's face, they put a light behind him, all you see is this dark. You know, just see the outline. They say, start, when you're meditating on this lama in front of you, put him in space, make him, you know, about this tall. Put him at level of here. He's at the same level here. And get his outline right. Don't try to color it in yet. When you get the outline pretty steady, then start to color in the features.
Michael, you mean the body also?
Just his outline as he's sitting. You know, if that's where, how he normally sits. And they say don't meditate on him if he has some physical defects, he's got a wart on his chin, or he's got a bald head, or whatever, you're supposed to imagine him as perfect and as young, and at the prime of his health. You're supposed to meditate on him as that.
Whether you meet him as young or old.
Yeah, right. Like, if I were meditating on Rinpoche, I would picture him as... I have a picture of him when he was in his prime, physically. And, you know, you're supposed to meditate on the lamas.
Does it have to be... you said lama is somebody... A root lama is somebody you have a connection with. Does it have to be Buddhist? Does a person... I mean, you have experiences in life where a person teaches you... They don't even know that they're teaching you Buddhist principles. But they are. And they have all the qualities... a Buddhist, but they don't call themselves Buddhist. Would that be a lama also?
I won't answer directly, but I'll say this. There are commentaries which say that your root lama is a Buddha. There's proofs why your root lama is a Buddha. And they're pretty long, and they're pretty interesting. And one of them is if he functions as a Buddha. In other words, if he teaches you, what, three principal paths? If he teaches you, or if he teaches the three trainings, morality, concentration, wisdom. If it's a person who teaches you that, if he's not the Buddha, he might as well be. He's the one who communicates it to you. You know, that's the teaching. That's why you're supposed to consider your root lama as holy as a Buddha. As to be kinder than the Buddhas, and more holy than the Buddhas. Because he's your window to the Buddha. If he didn't exist, you wouldn't have any communication with the Buddhas. So he's better than the Buddhas. And that's the...
Does that mean he has to be alive?
That's a good question. I don't believe he has to be alive, no.
It seems to me like you ought to visualize the merit field before you go for refuge in Jhana Bodhicitta, and they have the order backwards.
Yeah, you should... That's the way it does, though.
You're supposed to. Should you, though, go
for
refuge?
Yeah, I think when you go for refuge, you're automatically already thinking of that image of that person. And I'm saying minimum. If you have the mental ability, which frankly I don't, you know, visualize all of them is good. And you don't know who Nagarjuna was, and you don't know who Asanga was, and Shantideva. And over the time of your study, this will become more clear to you. You know what I mean? I didn't feel anything about Asanga. Nice name, you know. I could tell you two sentences about his life. And I don't know anything else about him, and I'm supposed to visualize it and take refuge in it. But once you've studied the perfection of wisdom, then you have a relationship with Asanga, and you can put him up there and you can imagine all the things he's doing for you. So you have to, it'll build up over time. And the same with the higher practices. You know, I used to get confused, all these deities and stuff. And frankly, I couldn't distinguish one from the other. They have different names. I don't know what's the difference, you know. I don't know what... If you ask me to write a paragraph about them, I can't. I don't know anything more about them than their names and what they look like. And it's very difficult at first. Later, there will come a time when you start to distinguish them because of a certain thing, of certain... things that go on, but not because not at the beginning. So as you study, maybe you add the lamas that you will study their works. And the same with Tsongkhapa. I mean, when we start the seven ingredients, you're supposed to invite Tsongkhapa. So who's Tsongkhapa? I remember when I couldn't say his name, you know, and you don't have any knowledge of who he is. You don't have knowledge of what he is. So start with your root lama, you know, whoever that is. If you don't have one, I think the Dalai Lama is easy. If you're learning from Rinpoche directly, it's very good if you can picture him. And a Buddha, if that's more comfortable for you, so you might find Tara, a lady Buddha, is easier for you. You know, that's up to you. So that's inviting them. Invite them, really believe that they're there in front of you. Because if they are who they are supposed to be, they can come. If they're not who they're supposed to be, not much reason to do all this stuff.
But like Michael, you say you can come, but First you said you have to have some connection with these people. Then you say they, you know, they will come to you. But how do you know? Well, let's say you don't choose the Dalai Lama, you don't choose Ken Rinpoche, you don't choose Tara, and you choose, let's say, you. You say you're not even the Lama. So, I mean, isn't that a little bit, not a contradiction, but I cannot understand the two.
I'm saying from personal experience, don't struggle with some being that you don't have any feeling about. it won't come. Find the one that's very comfortable and natural for you, and then exploit that natural feeling that you have for that teacher or that lama or whoever it is. Rather than struggling to picture some being that you don't know anything about, you have no feeling for, you have no idea what this being is or what his qualities are or anything, work with your root lama.
When you put a photograph of the Dalai Lama, mm-hmm. is that to help you visualize it, or is that for him to welcome himself, his own image, or?
What are the forms of images in Buddhism? You know, some religions don't allow you to make an image of the being, right? Or they get very sticky about the question. I think it's obvious. Those pictures are not the beings. You know, the Buddha there is not the being. When you achieve the path of seeing, which is when?
When you perceive emptiness directly.
Directly, yeah. As you come out of that. By the way, that's Nyamshan. Sorry. No one gets that wrong. I get that wrong. Nyamshan, I didn't tell you what it was, and it was on your homework.
Yeah, I saw it.
Nyamshan is specifically refers to the period in which you are meditating directly on emptiness. It's that meditative period in which you are meditating directly on emptiness. Normally, not always, but Nyamshan means that. Out of those 6 words for meditation or 7 words, mm-hmm. Nyamshan means that. And it is as opposed to jetop. Jetop means after you come out of that meditation, you're no longer in deep meditation. You're not in meditation much at all. You could be in some kind of contemplation. But you're aware of things around you again. And then in the experience of emptiness, when you come out, you realize that these pictures really do relate to an enlightened being. I mean, you get a whole different feeling about tankas.
What do you mean, relate?
When you see a tanka after that, you realize that this picture was drawn, this picture was copied by an artist who saw an earlier picture of Tara. And that picture was copied by an artist who saw an earlier picture of Tara. And blah, blah, blah. Until you get back to the person who saw Tara and drew her. Mm-hmm. So when you actually meet a tanka of Tara, and you, in after coming out of the direct perception of emptiness, you meet Buddhas directly. You are directly aware of the existence of Buddhas. Then you know that this is a very important thing. It's not just a piece of art anymore. And you can't really have that feeling before that. I don't know if you can really get that feeling before that. Intellectually, you understand what I'm saying. You know, intellectually, you know that. At some point, someone saw Tara directly and painted one. And try to remember that when you think about images. That's all. What was the next one?
The 7-8 greeting.
Yeah, now we get to the 7-8 greeting. What time is it?
And after 8. 4 after 8.
Okay, I think a good place to start there. There's snacks there. You might want to. I don't know if it's. You might have to heat up the soup. And you're welcome to just have. This book. Well, I'm going to talk about it. It does relate to number 5. Sambo Chöpa Rinpoche. Okay. Sambo Chöpa Rinpoche. Sambo Chöpa is a person's name. Samantha Barbara. I don't know if I told you that last time. Yeah. Okay. Samantha Barbara was a disciple of the Buddha. And this prayer is being taught in an exchange between him and another disciple. So Sambo Chöpa means Samadhi Bhagava. Munna means prayer. It's a very famous prayer, and we recite it often during during pujas, during services. And inside this prayer are the seven limb, is the seven limb practice, the original, the very first one, the seven ingredients, which relate to the fifth preliminary. Okay, that's a little tricky. So you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and number 5 has 7 steps. And those come from the Buddha. Those come from the time of the Buddha, those 7 steps. So what you have in the back of your notebook is Tsongkhapa explaining parts of this prayer. He's explaining the 7 parts, those 7 ingredients, and he's using this prayer. He's using the Sambhacchakkhumanam to explain each part. So those 7 steps in getting ready for meditation were taught by the Buddha. And they're very famous.
So the prayer is the Mon Lam?
Yeah.
And what is the Sambhacchakkhumanam?
Sambhacchakkhumanam means that the name of the disciple who spoke most of it under the influence of the Sambhacchakkhumanam.
I'm confused because in the order that you gave us...
I knew you might get confused, yeah.
I thought you said number 5 was purifying obstacles and gathering power of doing good deeds.
Yeah, and that has 7 parts.
Oh, that has... Oh.
Yeah, and that's what I want you to get straight because it's confusing. There are 6 preliminaries and the 5th one is how to get rid of all the negative things and get a lot of positive energy in you just before you meditate. It has 7 parts to it, and we're going to do that tonight. And that's what you're going to meditate about next. You've finished the 6 preliminaries. If you've been doing your meditation for the last few days, you've got it memorized, hopefully. It's very natural to you now. You know the correct order in which you're supposed to go. Mentally, you can do everything. That's the purpose of meditating on that. So now you've got to number 5, and you're going to have 7 steps to that. The first step is called...
Steps or ingredients, right?
I call them ingredients, yeah. It's a translation of, you know, Chaktsal. We talked about it last time because I got it wrong. I thought it was the first preliminary. This is prostration. Chaktsal. Prostration. In Sanskrit, it's namas. Yeah, it's still in India, they say namaskar. I namas to you. Namaskar.
You're prostrating.
And when they say Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, then the us changes to O in certain combinations. Namas Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya. That's what they chant in Sri Lanka or other countries. That's the Sanskrit. Excuse me?
You're prostrating after you've done the visualizations and gone for refuge and taken your posture?
Yeah, this is where it comes. And you can imagine...
It's a mental prostration.
Yeah.
Not that.
I mean, should you get up and re-prostrate? No. I mean, you're prostrating actually before you sit down. So the order is a little tricky here. But you will be reciting at this point a text. And it's important to recite the text verbally. And I'm going to give you a text to recite. By the way, if you already have your own morning practice, it should include these things. If it was designed properly, if the person gave it to you, like if you're doing Tunduk, or if you're doing a short Dakye, if you don't know what those are, you shouldn't worry about it, you're not supposed to know, then these things are already in there, and you don't have to worry about it. If you don't have those things, I'll give you one today.
Does the six-session Guru Yoga incorporate them?
The
six-session Guru Yoga incorporate them?
That's Tunduk.
Oh, I don't know. Did that?
Okay. Yeah, it does. Okay, so Chaktsal. Chaktsal is prostration. Before you sit down on your seat, you should do 3 prostrations to the image of the Buddha. Yeah. And we talked about it last time. And I said when I first went to India and I had to do this, I didn't feel comfortable doing it, and I didn't do it for a while. And if you want to, if you feel more comfortable, you know, just do some kind of pay some kind of respect to the image. And later, as you understand more, you'll feel more comfortable. I don't know if it's good to force it. If you don't feel comfortable, then I don't think it's good to force it. When you're ready, you can do a prostration. Yeah.
You're saying we should do the 3 prostrations as a preliminary?
Actually, before you sit down.
So that should really be...
You shouldn't get back up again.
So after cleaning...
It's like 2.5, really. Okay. Right?
Yeah, it should be in here,
in,
I guess.
In reciting, it will be, you'll say it again, but you don't have to get up again out of your position and do another prostrate. But in the recitation, you say I prostrate. You go down, the tradition is, these are all traditions. You know, you go down slowly. You're supposed to, you're supposed to put your thumbs inside like that. You're not supposed to go like this. The idea is that your hand is not empty, and this is some kind of jewel, and it has meaning. So you bend your thumbs inside. In this tradition, I know it's different in Thailand, but in this tradition, you go like that. And then you touch it here, here, and here. And it means body, speech, and mind of the Buddha. I wish I could get the way that the Buddha acts, the way that the Buddha talks, and the way that the Buddha thinks. And that's not, again, it's symbolic. You know, if you touch here, you're going to start acting like a Buddha. Probably not. But it's to keep those things in mind. Everything has a meaning. And if you keep everything having a meaning, it's not a ritual anymore. It has meaning. So touch your head, your mouth, and your heart. And then you go down. And when you go down, you're supposed to go down slowly. You're supposed to touch 5 points, which are your two palms. And then they're supposed to be flat on the ground. And that's supposed to be important. Your two knees, and then your head. And are that's called a five-point prostrate.
Can you do it if we move so we can see? I don't
yeah, know. It's like that.
But I mean, then what happens?
And then you go down, like, on all fours. And then you touch your head.
And you land up still on all fours?
Yeah. And then you're supposed to go down very slow. And that, and you're supposed to think as you go down, I hope I don't go to hell.
After I die.
And then you get up real fast. And that's a tradition. If you really do a prostration properly, that's a tradition.
The hardest.
Does hell exist? I can't prove it to you. When you study more about karma, you will be able to imagine that it could easily exist.
So is the head mind or is the heart mind when you do that?
This is body, speech, and mind. Because the mind in Buddhist philosophy is related to the heart, the area of the heart. The mind is here. The brain is here, admittedly. The real mind is here. Speech, mind.
When you do that, do you think body, speech,
and
yeah.
mind? You think, you know, you touch your head and you say, and you don't have to, if you don't feel comfortable with the Buddha, I mean, it's inconceivable how a Buddha thinks, you know? So you take the best person you know. I find that, personally, I find it easier. I mean, I can't imagine how a Buddha thinks, but I know how really good people that I know at work, for example, there are people at work I know who are just very naturally very admirable. And they really don't dislike anybody. They very naturally love the people around them. And, you know, I'd like to be like that. So you just imagine that body, speech, and mind. You'd like to be able to be like that. You'd like to not say anything bad. When you touch your mouth, you know, don't say anything bad today. You're really supposed to think that, you know, and think that. It's a good way to start your day, and it's a very powerful form of meditation. Get down slowly, come back up quickly, do it 3 times.
And touching the head on the ground, that means?
I can't tell you exactly. I know it's called 5 points, and they're all supposed to be down, touching at the same time for it to be a good meditation. There are many meanings. And you'll find contradictory meanings. It's not contradictory. Different lamas have different traditions, and they'll teach you that. Yeah.
I've heard people, this kind of, I think, is a bit far-fetched, but I've heard people say, you know, if you prostrate with your finger spread, you create causes for lower rebirth as an animal or something.
They say that, yeah. That books say that. I don't get into that. I don't get into that too deeply. I believe it. I believe it's true, probably. But I don't think you should, you know.
Spread your hands?
Don't dwell on it somewhere. Yeah. I don't think it's. I don't think you have to think too much about that. I mean, if you go down with a good motivation, and I have a feeling if you do everything wrong, it's probably quite good. You know, I don't want you to do it wrong. You should do it right. But I have a feeling your motivation is on 90% of it. Again, when you perceive emptiness directly, and you come out of that, your natural reaction is to get up and get down on the ground.
Oh, they can't do it. Okay.
Are the palms flat on the ground when you're clustering?
Yeah.
And they're not like this at all.
No. When you touch, they're inside. When you touch, then you open them up and go down. And you know, every country has its own way, and that's specific to that particular country. You're learning a Tibetan tradition. Your lineage lamas are Tibetan and Indian, and some Chinese, and you follow that tradition. Don't go to a Burmese temple and say, "No, that's all wrong." You know, we know how to do it right. And also, I don't suggest that you mix them. You know what I mean? Stick to one tradition that you are learning. They're all nice. They're all good. They're like good medicines. But if you get sick and you take three different medicines from three different doctors, it can kill you. Much less not help you. You know, so stick to one tradition that you feel close to and follow it. So don't mix both ways. Don't criticize good things about them. And don't mix up your own practice. Don't get it confused. You will get confused. So for the time being, do it that way. If if your whole life you've been doing a certain way, then keep it that way. That's what happens. You know what I mean? Because you come from a Buddhist country and you have your own. You've been doing that since you were a baby, so that's good. Keep it that way. If you're American, you don't have it yet. Okay, so that's right. So that's prostration.
I think three times.
Yeah.
And that meaning?
You can treat three ratnas.
Buddha.
Long story. Oh. have some is teaching and the people who are trying to follow it. Not necessarily. It's good to see. And it's
I would say that was simple to remember.
That's fine. We already had Chopra. It was number two of the preliminary.
Offering.
So it happens to be the second one of the seven also.
So you do it twice?
This time you're doing it mentally.
It's
a lot more fun.
Are all seven of these mental?
Yeah. You're down on your seat already. Now you have the being in front of you. I kind of like to think that this is like a... this is a mousetrap for them. Then you get them here, and then you present another one. Chopa offering. And you should read the text. I read it in the text. The first text. The text about the six Buddhas.
Chopa is offering?
Yeah. I'm going to play.
Time to quit.
The third one is Shakpa. Anybody remember Shakpa?
Declaring?
No. That's Sunda. Shakpa literally refers to, if you've ever been in India again, firewood is a big pain, it's a big hassle. You have to have firewood in India. And you buy these big logs and you spend like a couple hours every morning driving wedges into them with a sledgehammer. And you see these terribly skinny guys, you know, swinging a sledgehammer and then resting for a minute, and they spend like an hour or two like that. And finally the wood goes shak. That's shak. Shak means split open. And it means confession. It means to open your heart. You open yourself and say, look, I did some things wrong. I think Rinpoche doesn't like the word confession. He says it's got too many bad connotations in our minds. What it really is a purification process. And we can't go into it tonight, but there's a lot of steps to it. Basically, this is the one of the seven ingredients that you use to clean yourself. And it's very, very important for a good meditation. you cannot concentrate if you have something on your conscience. It won't happen. And I think you'll find that when you get better at chakra, chakra is an art. You get good at it. And then you can really improve yourself with chakra. When you get good at it, then you see that your meditation gets really good. I mean, mentally, confess to this being that you have the relationship with, honestly, openly, what you did wrong. And you get good at it, and then your life is also... I mean, at work, you get used to admitting what you did wrong, and people like it. You know, you protected it for so long. You thought it was the right thing to do to hide it. If you get in the habit of just admitting when you're wrong, it's very healthy, and it's very, very good for your meditation. I can't emphasize it enough. It really, really helps your meditation. Before you start, truly, honestly think of what you've done wrong and try to get this sense that by admitting it mentally to this being, you are pure of it and you finished it and you got rid of it. That's very important. Also, just before you die, this is very important. So if you die by accident, quickly, try to remember that. You know, try to imagine that there are all these processes, there are all these practices for it, but at least try to think mentally. If you've been doing this every morning for your life, you'll be able to do it when you die. The Catholic custom of having a priest there and you tell him the horrible things you did in your life is very good. And you try to clean yourself of it. You try to imagine that you're pure of it. And that's chakra. It doesn't mean you feel guilty or bad. You should feel guilty in the sense of, they say, having drunk a bottle of poison by accident. You know, like that, you know, man. I made a big mistake, you know. That's really the feeling. It's not so much like, oh, I'm a bad person, or I'm no good. It's like, oh, I made a big mistake. I shouldn't have done that. You know, like it's like some kind of strong feeling of having done something stupid that's going to hurt you.
So yeah. You never know when you're... that's a problem I run into, is I always have... people just kind of run over you, and you don't know whether to stand up for yourself and yell back, or...
when you study more, you'll know what to do. Yeah. You know, there are times when you have to be... There's Shige Wangdang in Tibetan. Being fierce is a religious reaction if you do it right. But it takes a lot of wisdom to do it right. At the beginning, better to make sure you're not angry. You know, better to be made a fool and to be taken advantage of than to make the wrong reaction. You don't lose anything by being taken advantage of. You lose a lot if you react wrongly.
Yeah, but we thought to always bring out the best in us. I mean, you say admit it to your job. Right. You know, admit that you made a mistake. You don't want to emphasize that. You want to emphasize the good things.
But I think what you'll find is that if people know that you're strong enough to admit your faults, and when the time comes, you know, there's the time when you could blame it on the guy, no one would know the difference.
Or you could say, actually, it was me. That's no good. But what I'm saying is, if you emphasize that, that's...
Well, try it. Maybe you become a vice president.
So would this be doing something like Vajrasattva visualization?
Yeah, that's a beautiful song. Okay.
Like prostrations and things like this.
Yeah. There's a whole thing about it, and we'll do it someday. We can go through it someday. But I have like 6 more years. Yirangwa.
Yirangwa.
Yirangwa means rejoicing. And I like that translation. You know, I'm always picking on the translation. That's a good translation. Rejoicing.
And this is in others, this is rejoicing in other people.
There's 2 kinds. One is to just being glad about the good things that other people do, A, and B, being glad about the right things you've done yourself. Some kind of being very happy about the good things. It's taught in many scriptures, and I've seen it many times, that if you truly take joy in other people's successes and in other people's good deeds, which is against our nature, we tend to be jealous. You can get 10% of the virtue. I mean, many scriptures I've seen have quoted the number 10%. So it must be somewhere, maybe 9 or maybe 9. But that's incredible. Like if you just sit down there, you're sitting there, you're about to go into deep meditation, hopefully, and you say, you know, the Dalai Lama really does a good job. I'm glad he's around. I heard the other, the man who died in New York yesterday was the financier of the private army that protected the Dalai Lama while he got out of Tibet. He came very close to never getting out of Tibet. So no Nobel Prize, no Arizona teaching, no Kala Chakras, no... You know, be glad that he got out and be glad about everything he did. And they say you can get 10% of the power. If you truly are happy about it, you can get a lot of the energy that he collects by doing those things. And that's immense. The second way is to be glad about what you have done yourself. And they say that's even more powerful. They say just to take joy in the amount of things you're able to do good in a day, to do right, has a multiplying effect. Everything else you do, if you do a good deed in the morning and you think about it all afternoon about, okay, I finally did something good, it multiplies it exponentially, they say. There's something about reviewing it mentally and being glad about what you did. That's very powerful. It's more powerful than rejoicing in someone else's deeds. And so that's actually, sometimes they even add that as a third part in this fifth practice one, right? Fifth preliminary. Mm-hmm. Which is, we're supposed to be cleaning ourselves out, which is what the confession does. We're supposed to be collecting good deeds, which is what the other six do. And rejoicing, they sometimes even separate that out and they say, this explodes your energy. You know, if you're happy about the good things that you're doing, it just explodes. Your energy, the good energy explodes. And my Lama is always saying that's very cheap, easy way. You know, no, not much work. You're just sitting there and being happy about yourself. And it builds up. And it expands the virtue you've done. So that's...
Isn't there the danger of being...
Thinking that you're good? Of course there's a danger. Of course there's a danger. But you can take a true joy in the good. You know when you've done something good. And the tse in Tibetan, the way... When you know it's good, is you feel good. You know? And if you do something really good, you know it. You really do know it. You have to be almost an animal not to know it. You do feel good. So you'll know. I don't. There is a danger in getting conceited, but you'll know the difference too. Hopefully, I'll make this short. Chukor korwa. Chukor means dharma, and kor means wheel. Dharma wheel, and chukor korwa means to turn the wheel of the dharma. And that means to teach.
Doesn't korwa mean samsara?
Yeah, because it's a circle.
Oh, so it's just the circle part.
Yeah, it's just the wheel part. The wheel of life.
Is korwa another word for chukor, or is it two separate words?
It's the verb. Okay. I'm not going to write the whole thing out for you. Chukor korwa means to turn the wheel of the dharma. And it means to teach. And what it... This is, I think, the one that Rinpoche seems to emphasize the most of all of them. Is asking that being, will you teach me? Please teach me. They say that a teacher is, as I said before, is your window to the Buddhas. If there's nobody in the world talking Dharma, then you're lost. Then there's no hope. Because the Buddha himself says many times in scriptures, I can't do anything for you except in rare circumstances, except teach you verbally what to do. You know, that's the big act of a Buddha. This is the big contribution of a Buddha. He comes and he talks and he teaches. And this is to ask him, please come, please teach me.
He's the window to the Dharma?
To the all other Buddhas. The person who teaches you Dharma. And it says in many great scriptures, many very high scriptures, therefore he's more important than all the other Buddhas. then, because without him you can't contact them.
So is this requesting him to teach?
Yeah, asking him to teach.
This is
mentally. And that teaching can take many forms. I mean, the Buddhas are capable of taking any form. So, that's one of their qualities. You don't know who's a Buddha. And you don't, you know, they're teaching you. You don't know. You have to be careful of that. And they can teach you in any way. I mean, it's in the scriptures that the Buddha took a form as a tree. The Buddha took a form as a wave of the ocean. The Buddha took the form of a bridge. You know.
I can teach you as a tree.
Maybe if you hit your head when you think you've got patience mastered. Yeah? Possible. No, don't think it's impossible. But normally it's plain old Dharma teaching. When you're ready for that, maybe before that it's a book, a novel or a movie or something that gets you up to Sunda means requesting. Okay? Sunda. It's the same word as the last preliminary, the sixth preliminary.
So always with an S. We had it. I
had it. Yeah, this is a better pronunciation. It's a little bit subtle pronunciation. If you do it that way, Tibetan will say, "Ooh." Sundat means to request. It specifically means to request your lama to stay and not to leave you. Suppose if he's a Buddha. Or if he's a holy being, he has the power to stay and not leave, not break the relationship with you, or not die. And a lot of students in the West have had lamas die. I mean, Lama Yeshe passed, Geshe Rabdin passed, Chogyam Rinpoche passed. So it happens, and you have to be very careful to request that they not die. Or pass on. The Buddha himself, on his deathbed, there's a tradition that one of his disciples neglected to ask him to stay, and therefore he died. Therefore he passed. Pretended to die. So it's important. It's important. The relationship is so precious and so rare to run into a good teacher that. It's important to ask that teacher not.
You don't mean literally. You mean the connection.
Well, in this prayer, you're doing it mentally. But if you have a relationship with some lama, you must ask him from time to time. You know, please, you know, keep the relationship. Okay, don't leave me.
And tell some sorry.
Literally, you have to ask the person.
Yeah.
Don't die.
Yeah. You know, when I was learning Tibetan, I met Ling Rinpoche, who was his Dalai Lama senior tutor. And I was his driver for a day. And I didn't know Tibetan very well, so I said something like, "Hey, don't die, okay?" And everybody started laughing. He's like, "Oh, don't worry." You know, people never let me forget it. I mean, 15 years later, they still remind me of that. But I feel like I did the right thing.
Yo, buddy. Stick around, all right?
It's important. We take it for granted, but there's many people who never meet a Dharma teacher. There's many people who don't meet a Dharma teacher who can lead them for very long. There's many people who, you know, they get it. I remember we were in Arizona, and His Holiness was answering questions. You were there, right?
Okay.
And somebody said, "If you meet your lama once a year, is it okay?" You know, many people live in places where the lama travels through once a year and gives a small teaching and leaves. You know, and it's rare. It's hard to find. It's hard to find the real thing. I think it's hard to get a long. Protracted relationship with Lama. Rinpoche stayed in the same place for 20 years and we soaked it up, you know. We were very fortunate. So it's very rare. It's a good chance. Okay, Moa. Moa's number 7.
So Michael, please keep teaching.
Don't die.
Maybe you should move.
Maybe you should put your diamonds in New Jersey.
Oh, nice. Jersey, Michael.
Uptown, Midtown, whatever.
Park Avenue.
Bigger place.
Janet, is that
Emma? Moa means...
No, but it's in the crack haven.
Moa means...
They want him to stay alive.
So Moa means dedication. And dedication means...
Computer.
Dedication?
Sorry.
What? Just say that.
This is more, I should think, after the meditation. It's one of the preliminaries. But you can dedication, and there's a question on your homework. I'm going to explain the difference between Munlam and Moa. Munlam we had before, it meant prayer. It wasn't one of the seven, and it wasn't one of the six. It was the name of the book. The original book was the prayer of Samatha Bhadra. And so there's two, and in Tibetan books and in Buddhist books in general, they say it's very important to know the difference between a munlam and a moa, a dedication and a prayer. Prayer means, you know, I pray that these good things happen. That's a munlam. That's a prayer. A dedication is different. In a dedication, the main difference is you have some stuff to dedicate. You have something good that you did. And moa means I wrap it up and package it and I think to myself, I did a good thing, and by this power may I become a Buddha. By this power may I reach paradise. You know, consciously, after doing something right, like that meditation you just did, think of it as one good thing you did, one unit, and send it into the future. And they say that if you do that, that virtue, that good deed, is protected from all your angers, all your hatreds. They say normally if you get angry during that day, then even if you had a great morning meditation, you've just destroyed all of its power. If you get angry for a short period during the day, truly angry at someone, then if you did... Actually, the book says many thousands of years, millions of years. That's kind of scary. Think of it as that morning's good deed. The power is totally wasted. If you moa, if as you finish your practice, you say, I really truly wish that this would bring me to a state of perfect knowledge where I could really help other people. I know what they're thinking. I know what they need. I know what their future is. Then that protects it. That motivation after you've done that good deed protects it.
How does that work? Why?
Is that a one-way street? I mean, you know, you suddenly get angry and you wipe out eons of virtue. Or is it also, you suddenly rejoice the right way and you accumulate?
No, that's what.
Or you wipe out eons of non-virtue.
I've never seen it referred to as wiping out eons of non-virtue. There's certain, but maybe there is in a way. The Buddha once met, before he became a Buddha, he met another Buddha. Out of awe for him, He hopped around him on one leg, I don't know, for a day or 2 days or something. That's some kind of reverential... It's very famous in the scripture. And because of that one deed, he shortened his samsara by thousands of eons. It depends. Yeah, you can do that. According to the scripture,
but once you dedicate it, you cannot destroy it, right? You couldn't destroy it. Once the dedication...
Right, yeah. It protects it.
It protects it.
How does it protect it? I think the power of the motivation. It's no longer a worldly... It's no longer a normal karma. It's not going to produce the normal, just simple reaction. How does it work? It has to do with the mind-only school. And the perceptions you have as the seed is planted karmically in your mind. And it's explained. It takes about a month.
But it takes hatred, not just anger, right? I mean, this holiness explained it. You know, when you just say anger wipes out all your virtue, it's actually hatred, right? Not anger.
I guess it's the hatred in anger or something.
Not just simple anger.
Yeah. There are virtuous kinds of indignation against
I thought, as His Holiness explained, that it's like more of the hatred is a correct translation.
Yeah, Shantideva explained to us. The root is hatred. It is a form of hatred.
So if you get angry and you're not hateful, then it doesn't wipe out eons of virtue, is my understanding.
There's a lot of... it's a long story. All right. It's in the Magna Nikamatara.
So would you briefly explain the difference between prayer and...
Yeah, the difference is that in dedication, there's a thing that you are... It's called a substance in Tibetan. There's some substantial thing that you are using to do, to dedicate to your future enlightenment. And that substantial thing is what? It's the virtue of the deed you just did. And that's why at the end of this class we always do more. That's more. That's the classic more. Okay, that's the classic. So that's number 7. That brings us to the last thing. Sorry to keep you over. That finishes the 7 ingredients.
Right? All right.
Now we have the 6th preliminary. And that's again sundab. It's the same word as before. Again, it's requesting or supplicating.
So I don't get it. So you do it twice in a row? Basically?
It's a different kind of request. The number, what was it, number 5? The last request was asking them not to die.
Yeah.
This request was asking them to... This is the 6th preliminary. We finished the 7 ingredients. Okay, everybody got that? We finished the 7 ingredients.
7 was Noah, right?
Yeah, Noah. Okay. We finished the 7 ingredients, which are part of preliminary number 5.
Right.
Now we're on the last preliminary, the last thing for now. This is requesting that holy being to give you jinlap. Jinlap. Okay, jinlap.
Number 6, not number 5.
Right, of the preliminary.
Give you
what? Requesting who?
That holy being or beings. I mean, ideally, you can meditate. You can. You're seeing a lot of lamas in front of you, and your lama, your root lama, in the center. Jinlap is a very hard word to translate. It means. Do you know the difference between aptitude? What are those two kinds of tests? Aptitude and.
Knowledge.
There's two kinds of examinations.
Stability.
They sound similar. Anyway, one kind of exam. This is like Western testing, like the SATs. One is to measure your what you actually know. I forget the word for it. And the other one is to measure your ability to change, like the potential in you for knowing something.
Intelligence,
so intelligence as opposed to aptitude. Aptitude means what you're capable of learning, your capability of learning, and the other is intelligence, which means how much you know now. Like you can be unintelligent now, but if you have a high aptitude, if you work hard. So jinlap refers to aptitude. It's a prayer that they, through their blessings, they change your aptitude.
Potential to learn.
Your potential to be holy.
Or whatever.
Okay. Your potential to gain high spiritual goals. Jinlap is that process. Jinlap means you're requesting them to give you jinlap. Jinlap is translated as blessing, but what it means is through the relationship you have with them, they somehow affect your ability to become better. And the book says, I pray that you change my ability from the very first practice up to the very highest practice. The very first practice is acting properly towards your teacher, your lama. And the very highest practice is perceiving emptiness directly. So the prayer is, the sundap is all the way from that beginning practice, which is having a good relationship with your teacher, because if you don't have that, you're not going to learn anything. All the way up to perceiving emptiness directly, I pray that you change my ability to act right, to be able to do all those things. All the long rims, all the paths, all the steps to the path. And I have to do, there's a few things on the homework I didn't cover. How many of the 6 preliminary, I'm sorry, of the 7 ingredients, how many act to purify you and how many act to collect goodness? There's only one which is solely purification, and that's the confession. And that's in your reading. This is all in your reading. And the rest of the seven act to collect virtue. Positive energy to make your meditation session successful. The other six.
Can you say that again?
One is?
The one ingredient of, one of the seven ingredients, which is confession, acts to remove negative energy before your meditation. And the other six act to store up positive energy for your meditation.
Some of the sadness, they have visualizations where you visualize some kind of light passing through you, so that would be part of
that's that. That's that. That's and all good sadness have all seven ingredients embedded in them. And when you get better, you can recognize them.
Acts to accumulate a bit.
Store up good deeds, good energy. I forgot to mention one thing in confession. What you confess, if you've been practicing for a while, is any time you broke one of the three kinds of vows. And I just want to mention the three kinds of vows. The first kind of vows are vows of morality. Monk's vows are those. You can also take lifetime vows without becoming a monk. That's the first kind of thing you can confess. Second kind is things when you broke your bodhisattva vows. If you don't know what they are, don't worry. You'll learn sometime. And the third kind of vows are your secret vows. For our reciting the seven ingredients in the morning. And that's this. Ganden Ha Gyama. HLA. Ganden Ha Gyama. Say Ganden.
Ganden.
Hagyama.
Hagyama.
Ganden.
Ganden.
Hagyama. Now here's the punchline. It's the last thing I'll say. I keep saying that, right? Someone took Tsongkhapa's analysis of the Buddha's teaching on the seven ingredients and made him the object of a prayer of the seven ingredients. So there's a prayer you do in the morning, before your meditation, and the one we use is called Ganden Ha Gyama. And it's centered, it's focused on Tsongkhapa himself. He was teaching the seven ingredients, and then he was 100 years later, somebody wrote a seven ingredient focused on him. And that's the classic one, that's the one we use. And that's in the back of your notebook. So in the morning, when it comes time to do your seven ingredients, you can recite that one. It's there in English, and it's better if you can do it in the Tibetan pronunciation, which is also there.
Why is that better?
Excuse me?
Why is that better in Tibetan?
You put a seed in yourself.
To be Tibetan?
To learn it later.
Learn it in English.
Ganden means, it's a name of a heaven. It's called the heaven of bliss. Ganden means heaven of bliss. Pla means angel. Angel. Plop, plop, plop. Ya means 100.
100?
100. Ma is, again, that feminine ending for a very holy prayer.
Isn't it also mother?
Yeah. In every language. It's been translated as the thousand angels of the heaven of bliss. Because the word 100 here just means a lot. Okay. You could have said million or billion, it would have been all right. And in this prayer, in this visualization, Tsongkhapa is coming out of the heart of Maitreya. And if you'd like to see it after class, you should go downstairs, there's a big tanka there, which Margie donated to the center. And that's a tanka of that process going on. Tsongkhapa is coming out of the heart of that main angel, that main angel. Yeah.
So in this, we're really, in the six preliminaries, we're doing prostrations twice, once physically and once mentally.
Yes.
And we're doing offerings twice, once physically and once mentally.
Right.
Any reason why we do it twice?
It's just better than what? When you get up before you get up, imagine that that holy being shrinks and goes and stays inside your heart. It's not good luck. It's not considered good to just get up and let him disappear. Shrink him down and let it comes through the top of your head. It comes down and it stays in your heart. And you get up and you spend the day with him or her.
That's, it is. That's after requesting?
That's after requesting. And then they come and stay in your heart. And that's a very good sign when you finish. I requested Rinpoche to come. I did not teach you Gandhi Hanyama. You can recite it because now you know all the parts of it. And Rinpoche has agreed to come and teach that. And that will be after this course ends, actually. It'll be April. April 26th. April 24th. It's a Sunday. Here. Hopefully there will be warm enough to be outside. If not, I have to see. We might try to find a bigger place. But he's agreed to come. And I think it's better if you get it from him than from me. So actually, the Gandhi Hanyama, that practice, he'll do in detail. So your homework is to recite this thing. It's to memorize the seven limbs. And I encourage you, if you don't have another practice, recite the Gandhi Hanyama. It's in the back of your notebook. And then do your meditation practice. How do you sit? How do you think? We don't know yet. Do it as best you can, and then that's the next class. We'll talk about the place, how you're the characteristics of the place. Kylie,
well, you have to wait for the dumb class, not the homework.
Sāshī bhūrgī jūrshīn netā jāṁ rīrā vīṁshī nyamdē gyāmpā dī sāṅgē shindū mithē uvāgī jōgū nāmbā shīmā jūpā
This is the end of Class 2.